I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and from WUOT News, this is Dialogue. President Trump has made great sport of undermining and attacking journalists before and since taking office.
The press, honestly, is out of control. The level of dishonesty is out of control.
But he's not the first chief executive to have a rough relationship with the reporters who cover him.
I have never heard or seen such outrageous, vicious, distorted reporting. I'm not blaming anybody for that.
One can only be angry with those he respects.
Aggressiveness, friendship, stonewalling, even obsequiousness. Presidents of both major parties have handled their relationship with journalists in different ways. Today, a closer look at those relationships as we discuss the history of the presidency and the press. Join us for Dialogue after the news. This is Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. President Trump has a rocky relationship with the journalists who cover him and his administration, but he's not the first chief executive to have some problems with the press. On this edition of our program, we hear about the history of the White House press corps and its dynamics with the man who sits in the Oval Office. We're joined today by historian emeritus of the U.S. Senate, Donald Ritchie. He is the author of Reporting from Washington, The History of the Washington Press Corps, and he joins us from a studio at NPR headquarters in Washington. Don, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I guess I want to get started. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about this with you today and with our listeners, it's been a year since President Trump was elected, and we've seen and heard a lot about his specific relationship with the press. But I want to zoom out a little bit and talk more about how various presidents have handled their relationships with journalists, at times acrimonious, sometimes friendly, the way we interact with most people that we have in our lives. So what I wanted to establish a little bit was this commonality that we see, this common sight of the press secretary jousting with reporters on the daily press briefings in the familiar James Brady press briefing room has not always been the case. When was the White House beat, as we currently understand it, established?
Well, in the 19th century, reporters tried to cover the White House, but presidents would let them in, but there was no space for them to operate in there. So most of the time, they stood outside on the street and interviewed people as they came and went. And it was President McKinley in the 1890s who finally set aside a little space for them in the White House. And then over time, that space grew and grew, and finally, President Nixon had a swimming pool filled in, and the current press room is established. But it's been a very gradual evolution over time.
It sounds like it. If you're going from McKinley to Nixon and then, of course, continuing to, I think the Brady press briefing room was renovated most recently about 10 years ago. So that's still an evolution that's going on. In terms of the workspace anyway, let's talk a little bit about the people. Before there was such a thing as an established White House press corps, and by that I mean people are now assigned to the White House beat. You might hear that title on the news, Chief White House Correspondent, or Joe Smith, who covers the president for XYZ News. Before there was such a thing as the established White House press corps, who did cover the president? Was that pretty ad hoc?
Well, surprisingly, Congress generated much more news in the 19th century than the president did. And so Congress had very nice press galleries and press rooms, and reporters could go there to work. There was so little news coming out of the White House that when Congress adjourned, most newspapers took their Washington correspondents out of Washington, and they relied on the wire services and a couple of the local newspapers in Washington to cover the White House. So presidents just weren't expected to generate a great amount of news.
Yeah, you write in your book, this was not actually considered a plum assignment. Reporters avoided covering the White House, so they didn't want to be sent to Washington. Why is that?
That's right. They used to say that the Senate was the ideal place to work, but that if you like to play pinochle, the White House was a great place to go down to. And you were dependent on presidential press spokesmen to hand out press releases and tell you what was going on. You really didn't have the run of the place. Some presidents in the 19th century were willing to talk to reporters, but off the record. You couldn't quote them on anything. The first president to actually give an interview was Andrew Johnson, who got into such trouble during Reconstruction that he realized he had to be able to talk directly to the people to defend himself, and so he allowed reporters to interview him. But most presidents really didn't like the press. And in fact, when Grover Cleveland was president, his cabinet secretaries wouldn't even be seen walking on the street with a reporter, just in fear that the president might see them.
Well, the evolution to what we now think of as the White House press corps began to come in Franklin Roosevelt's administration. And do correct me if I'm wrong. We started to see some of the more modern trappings coming in. Tell me, why did that relationship begin to change? What happened in Roosevelt's administration that gave us some of the underpinnings of the current dynamic we see?
Well, there's an interesting dynamic. When a president takes office after a president who's seen to have been unsuccessful, the best thing that the incoming president can do is everything the opposite of what the previous president did. And President Herbert Hoover had just terrible relations with the press. He was very curt with them. He wouldn't take questions except on paper. He wouldn't answer most of the questions that they gave him. He held very few press conferences. So Franklin Roosevelt adopted a very open policy towards the press. He had twice weekly press conferences in the Oval Office. He bantered with the press. Of course, you didn't have TV in there at the time, but pretty much most everything that he said was on the record and could be quoted, and he could be quoted saying those things. He knew that most of the editors of the newspapers who wrote the editorials were actually opposed to him and his policies. But he felt that if he could win over the reporters, then he could at least get his word out and he could get a relatively sympathetic hearing and a reporting on his administration. And he was very successful at that during his 12 years in office.
That was actually going to be my next question, is how successful that is. I know many reporters pride themselves on being independent or sometimes, especially with commentators or columnists, being particularly stubborn about it and saying, well, you know, you're not going to put a leash on me. I'm going to call your policy junk if I feel like it's junk or good if I feel like it's good. He had some real problems with some of the columnists, the influential columnists of the era who just didn't take the bait.
Yes, because all presidents would like to control the news that comes out. They'd like the press to report what they put into their press releases. But the good reporters always go behind the press releases to find out what's really going on. They want to release things before the president is ready to do that. And President Roosevelt had a particularly difficult time with the columnists. The columnists were not expected to be objective. They were advocates. They could take positions. And in particular, the New York Times had a very good reporter, Arthur Kroc, who'd been a longtime correspondent going back to the Woodrow Wilson era. And he was the chief of the New York Times Bureau, and he also had a column in the very, very influential New York Times. And Roosevelt could never quite get Kroc on board. He couldn't get him to say the things he wanted to say. And so Roosevelt tried terribly during the 1930s to get the New York Times to fire Kroc or to move him up to New York or get him out of town some way or another. But ironically, every once in a while, Roosevelt really needed Kroc. He needed to get his message across. And so on two occasions, he gave Kroc exclusive interviews, and Kroc won the Pulitzer Prize because of that, despite the fact that the president had been trying so hard to get him out of town.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I was thinking to complaints about leaks, about reporters going past the president. You said went beyond the press release. So they might talk to people inside the administration. They might talk to functionaries, people who were involved or close to policy matters in the State Department or somewhere else to get the story that maybe the president and the press secretary didn't want to give them. President Trump has complained about leaks. President Obama has complained about leaks. But they're not new. That's been something that's been a part of Washington reporting for decades, right?
No, leaks are part of the whole operation of the city of Washington. Mm. A leak is essentially the flip side of a press release. The leak is what the people in power didn't necessarily want to come out. Although in some cases, the people in power are the ones actually leaking the information as a trial balloon to see what the public reaction is. And if the public doesn't like what they hear, they can disassociate themselves with it. But in many cases, it's because there's actual policy disagreements within an administration. And for everyone who is in favor of a particular policy, there's usually somebody or an equal group that are opposed. And those who are opposed will get that information out if they think the public needs to know that. And so it's almost impossible for presidents to be able to control what information goes out. And it always frustrates them. Going way back, I mean, poor President Lincoln had to go up to talk to a congressional committee about why his a report to Congress, which his annual message to Congress, got into the newspapers before he was able to send it up to them. There were leaks in all the administrations. In fact, in the 19th century, there were a couple of occasions where the Senate actually held reporters prisoner in the Capitol building to force them to divulge who leaked information to them. And they never were able to find the sources.
Wow. President Roosevelt, this is Franklin Roosevelt we're talking about for folks who are just joining us, also presided over a transition in media. Before his administration, it would have been newspapers or magazines that would have been the primary medium for a president to reach the public. But when Roosevelt came along, radio was starting to grow in popularity. That continued through Harry Truman's administration. Eventually, we saw television. How have different presidents handled different media in talking to, maybe you're comfortable in print, mm-hmm. but, oh, you know, you get on the radio, it's a little more unscripted, and you say something you don't mean to say, and it goes out, as opposed to being censored out or edited out in the print process. How have different presidents handled that talking to different media?
Well, looking at the history of the Washington Press Corps, there are definite patterns develop. Reporters need high place sources. They need to get people who actually know what's going on to tell them what's happening so that they can write something in an authoritative manner. And they can't have terrible relations with those high place sources if they're going to be able to go back to them. So the media usually works out arrangements with their sources to say, well, you can talk off the record, or this can be a deep background, and I certainly am not going to write anything about your personal life. And there are all these sort of restrictions that go on to the news, and that works fine until a new form of technology comes along and brings in a new form of media. And so the newspapers had a fine way of operating with the politicians, and then all of a sudden the mass-produced magazines came along and muckrakers came along to stir things up a little bit. And then they worked out the arrangement after that, and then radio came along in the 1920s. And then in the 1940s, it was television, and then in the 1990s, it was the internet. And so each time these nice arrangements seemed to settle in, and politicians, including all the presidents, figure out how to use them, then there's some kind of conflicting technology. Franklin Roosevelt was a master at using the radio. His predecessor, Herbert Hoover, had a voice that sounded like a man who didn't like to speak, and he was really pretty boring to listen to for the most part. Roosevelt had a voice like a magnificent pipe organ, and people just loved to tune in and to listen to him. Even if they disagreed with him, they liked to listen to him. He began not only to do public speeches, but he began to do fireside chats. And in the evening, he would give a talk about some particular issue that was up before the nation about the banking issue, or during World War II, he would tell people to open up their maps and look over the way that the military was operating. And people felt that they had a personal relationship with the president. It was just a magnificent use of a media. Harry Truman had a voice that didn't quite come over the same way that Roosevelt did. And so Truman wasn't as good on the radio, although Truman got television in his era. And then you see presidents coming along because they're photogenic. And Kennedy certainly mastered television, as the first president to have televised press conferences. Other presidents have not performed as well in front of the cameras.
Indeed, we will come right back and continue this conversation with Donald Ritchie. He's the historian emeritus of the United States Senate and the author of a book about the history of the Washington Press Corps. Our topic today, the presidency and the press. And I want to follow up on that transition in technology, Don. So be thinking about that as we take a station break at 19 minutes after the hour. This is Dialogue from WUOT News. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. You can tweet your questions about the presidency and the press to us at WUOTFM. You can also give us a call at 974-5050. We continue along with our guest, Donald Ritchie, historian emeritus of the U.S. Senate. Right before the break, Don, we talked about fireside chats, about Truman and television, about President Kennedy and his ease in front of cameras. And that reminds me that there are times in the history of the presidency where that person has wanted to reach past reporters and directly to the public. And in particular, I'm thinking of Richard Nixon, who had, of course, famously frosty relations with the press and was skeptical of the press. But he thought that television addresses and TV press conferences were really where he could shine because he could talk directly to people without worrying about being filtered or mistaken or taken out of context. In more recent years, we've seen President Obama and President Trump in particular going to Twitter and to social media to reach past reporters. Tell me a little bit about presidents who have done that.
Oh, yes. Presidents would love to be able to talk directly to the nation. They would love to not have somebody interpret what they're saying. They would love to have not have somebody filter what they're saying. But, of course, the problem is that most people are too busy to listen all the time. And so we take our news in smaller chunks that are written up by the press or by broadcast on the radio or television from time to time. But presidents are always trying to think of some way that they can use the media to get that direct message across. If you're a good orator, as Barack Obama was, you give a lot of speeches, and the media tends to cover those speeches. Some presidents have just not been great orators. Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter weren't the type of people you really wanted to spend a lot of time listening to. So they would, you know, they would figure ways to bring their news out to the public directly. Ronald Reagan was probably the most gifted because, of course, he'd spent his early career as a movie star, and he knew how to stage the news. In fact, his press conference said, press secretary at one point said, "Don't tell us how to stage the news, you know, at all. You know, that's our business." And President Reagan, for instance, would give his speeches in front of the Statue of Liberty. Or he'd go out to Mount Rushmore or have some dramatic backdrop in the press. It almost didn't make any difference what he was saying. He just looked good, and he looked authoritative while he was doing it. And so it's getting your message across in the way that you want it that presidents are most concerned with. President Nixon loved to have basically avoided the press. He just didn't like reporters. And in 1960, he ran against a man who actually liked reporters, had been a reporter. John F. Kennedy had started out as a reporter for a newspaper, but wanted to actually make news rather than just report news. So Kennedy made himself available to reporters, and reporters liked him, and they generally wrote about him favorably. Nixon put up a wall around himself and didn't want the press too close to him, and they felt that hostility, and it colored the way that the people reported on him. So he would much prefer to have given his speeches directly to the silent majority, as he said, rather than having the reporters tell the public what it was he was saying.
One thread I've noticed through the history, at least of the 20th century, is that the president, regardless of party, policy, or platform, tends to think of the press as being against him. Lyndon Johnson routinely expressed frustration that reporters and editors did not openly support his goals and policies. Franklin Roosevelt, as we talked about a little earlier this hour, had similar issues where he wanted people to not just report what was going on, but take his side. I think Nixon probably would have felt the same way. Has there ever been a president that didn't feel like the press was against him? Is this just a dynamic that just develops because of the nature of that relationship?
Yeah, there's something about being in office that seems to bring that feeling on. There have certainly been presidents who have had good relations with the press. I mentioned William McKinley, seemed a very benign sort of person whom the press liked and they protected. They actually made him seem a little bit more authoritative than he actually was. Calvin Coolidge is a president who was not the most dynamic person ever to serve in the White House, and the press actually made up stories to make him sound more dynamic to give him a good press relationship. The press started out liking Herbert Hoover because they'd admired him so much as Secretary of Commerce and previous things that he'd done, and they were shocked at how he really kept them at arm's length. And he alienated them very quickly in his administration. So there's certainly relations that have soured over time. There are some presidents who have had the gift of doing it. And I certainly think that John Kennedy and Ronald Reagan in recent years are the ones who mastered their press relations the best.
I want to focus a little bit on Lyndon Johnson for just a moment. We're going through the 50th anniversary of his administration. And as I've been reading up on him, I've been fascinated by how he was constantly vexed by his relationship with reporters. He, as you know, and Lady Bird Johnson, the First Lady, had stakes in television and radio stations in Texas. They clearly had some understanding of the business of media. And Johnson, I think, wanted to be lauded in the press. He wanted to speak to the American people, so he issued press releases constantly, held press conferences at all hours of the day. He would tailor his addresses to hit prime time for the big three networks, and yet would also try to micromanage the press. He was not above, and often did, call the head of a network, like Frank Stanton over at CBS, and complain about a particular story that he saw. He would call the producer of the Today Show, and wanted to talk to Hugh Downs, who was the host at the time, if he wanted to pick a bone with somebody while the show was on the air. I can't imagine that was a particularly healthy way to manage relations with the press, but that's something Lyndon Johnson had no hesitation about doing.
Well, there's something called the Johnson treatment. Whenever Johnson wanted something, he was all over you. He was the kind of hands-on man, essentially. And he did that as Senate Majority Leader, and he did it as President of the United States. He thought that he could win over the press by being overly generous to them, allowing them to come down to visit him at his ranch and drive him around. He would drive them through the backwoods of his ranch. He told reporters, if you stick close to me, I'll make you famous. He felt that he could manipulate the press by essentially providing them with the kinds of information that they wanted. And, of course, reporters don't want to be manipulated. They do need that information, but they're also skeptical of the information that they're getting. And as soon as reporters began to express their skepticism, Johnson reared away. He was offended that somehow they weren't as nice to him as they always had been.
It feels like he thought there should be a quid pro quo. That's how it seemed, how he perceived his relationship with the press, right?
I think so, and I think it probably came from his many years as a Senate Majority Leader, in which that's how you operated. Somebody else wanted something, you wanted something, you traded off somehow in the process. And he was always able to find political allies, but he never quite was able to do the same thing with reporters. As hard as he worked, his press relations got worse and worse during his administration. Mm.
Part of the president's relationship with reporters in general is that unique beast we call the press conference. It is live, it's unscripted, it's often being telecast as it's happening, in most cases shown live, and it can be either a place for a president to shine or to really falter. Which presidents handled press conferences specifically the best, and which ones didn't handle them so well?
Well, before John Kennedy, press conferences were not televised, although Eisenhower had his televised, but they were not to be released right away. They wanted to have a sort of a fail-safe situation where they could delete something that shouldn't go out. Eisenhower was not the most articulate man. David Brinkley talked about trying desperately to clip together enough of an Eisenhower press conference to put on a few minutes on the evening news. And he said he just couldn't do it. It couldn't get something where Eisenhower actually finished a sentence that he started. John F. Kennedy was very different. And it was Kennedy who brings in the live television conferences. He was quite smooth with the press. He didn't always tell them exactly what they wanted to know. He knew how to change the topic. And if he really got into trouble, he knew there were a couple of really eccentric reporters out there, and he could call on them, and they would ask a question that was way off the mark, and everybody would laugh, and they would move on to the next subject. But that put the pressure on subsequent presidents to be able to stand up there and face the press and answer questions, talk about things that it might not be good to talk about right away, answer questions that you might not want to answer. It requires a dexterity that some politicians just don't have.
Through much of the mid-20th century, there were parallel publications and even wire services for African-American audiences. You write that two of the biggest were the Associated Negro Press and the National Negro Publishers Association, which existed for several decades. They helped cultivate black journalists who were covering politics, but you also write that the Washington Press Corps was slower to integrate than Major League Baseball. Tell me a little bit about that history.
Yes, it's a little ironic that the press corps is seen somehow as a liberal institution, and yet they were very slow to not only to allow in African-Americans, but also women. It was essentially an old boys network that was operating. And in the 19th century, they set up a series of rules to essentially get lobbyists out of the press galleries. And so basically, to be a newspaper reporter, you had to write for a daily newspaper, and you had to send your news back by telegraph, by wire. Well, that eliminated all of the black reporters because the black press in those days was a weekly press rather than a daily press, and white newspapers were not hiring black reporters. So there were black reporters. There was certainly a need for news in the black community, and yet they could not get the press passes that they needed to get them into President Roosevelt's press conferences or to get into the press galleries at the Senate and the House. It's not till 1947 that the Senate actually orders the press gallery to admit the first black reporter. And it's a very slow process. But for a very long time, the black press operated pretty much on its own, on a shoestring. And those press services that you mentioned covered the news. And there were dozens and dozens of black newspapers that existed in this time period that reached a part of the community that the white mainstream press was just not reporting on.
What caused the demise of those services geared toward African-American readers?
Oh, ironically, it was integration, civil rights integration that basically opened the doors to black reporters and white newspapers and made the mainstream press much more conscious of what it had to report. You know, I've done research, for instance, in Chicago and Chicago politics, and you can go for decades in which the Chicago Tribune doesn't mention any black candidates for office, and yet they were running and getting elected. You have to go to the Chicago Defender to read the story about the black politicians. Well, today, of course, the Chicago Tribune covers black politicians as equally with white politicians. And so there wasn't the need then for a separate Associated Negro Press as there had been before. But for many years, it was the lifeline, essentially, for black news.
Presidents didn't always know what to do with minority correspondents. President Eisenhower, you wrote, had to be reminded to call on them at press conferences. And in one of his interviews after retirement, President Eisenhower asked his interlocutor, Simeon Booker, why he was asking so many questions about civil rights. He didn't seem to quite get the importance to the audience. So there was a learning curve there.
Well, Eisenhower did not call on the black women who were reporting from the White House in those days because he knew they were always going to ask him a question on civil rights, and it irked him. But, of course, he didn't want to talk about civil rights. It was a difficult issue, and he wanted to avoid any kind of controversies. The black press was pressing him because he wasn't talking about those issues. There were two women, Ethel Payne and Alice Dunnigan, who covered the White House and covered Congress in those days as well. When President Kennedy came into office, he very pointedly, on his first press conference, called on both Ethel Payne and Alice Dunnigan. He wanted to show that he was open to their questions. And, of course, they were going to ask questions about civil rights.
The National Press Club integrated in 1955, but it would still be years longer before it decided to admit women. Some of the most prominent women in journalism at that time were actually on the political beat. There was Pauline Frederick at NBC, Nancy Dickerson first at NBC, then CBS, and, of course, Helen Thomas of the United Press Wire, who covered the White House for years. How did they interact with the presidents they covered?
Oh, they were very important figures, and, of course, they covered the news pretty much the way the men did, but often with an emphasis that women readers would be interested in. Helen Thomas started out covering the first lady, but she morphed into covering the president as well. They were a very important part of the press corps, and they had been in the 19th century as well. They wrote the more colorful pieces, the less heavily political, the more social reporting that came out of Washington, and there was always been a demand for that. But the astonishing thing is that the press corps did everything possible to keep women from reporting political news. And you mentioned the National Press Club, which is a place that has a lot of offices for reporters. It also has a restaurant. It has a bar. It has a regular speakers series in which important people come to talk. And the women were absolutely barred until they finally said, "Okay, you can come in, but you can't eat with us. You have to go up into the balcony and watch from the balcony." Very uncomfortable balcony. So the women would be up there looking down on the men who were having lunch and listening to the main speakers down below. They fought for years finally to integrate the National Press Club, and it wasn't until the 1970s that the National Press Club and the Gridiron Club finally gave in and realized that women were reporters as well.
Well, as we move forward in time, we get to the Nixon administration. We talked about Lyndon Johnson's struggles with the press and some of the situations that he struggled over, including Vietnam and urban unrest, were still going on when Nixon took office. As we've alluded to already, he didn't trust reporters. He didn't like interacting with reporters. But there was a time in the country where people wanted to hear what the president had to say. He certainly had things he wanted to say. Let's talk a little bit, just in broad strokes, about his general relationship with the press. He would occasionally take to TV to deliver addresses and do televised press conferences. What was that relationship like?
Yeah. Well, there were certain reporters who Nixon liked and who gave him an easy pass. He liked reporters from the conservative news networks and the conservative newspapers. He had a series of people who he would always sort of open his door to. He hired Clark Mollenhoff to be on his staff. He was a famous investigative reporter from the Des Moines newspaper. So he had very good, you know, press advisors who were telling him how he should operate with the press. But he had a deep suspicion and an instinct that went against the press. He particularly disliked television news. And he disliked the fact that when he finished giving a speech, that there would be instant analysis in which the TV announcers would come on to explain briefly, essentially, what the president had said and to critique it. And it just irked Nixon to no end. And so Nixon sent his vice president, Spiro Agnew, out to specifically attack the media. And this is the beginning, I think. There had been attacks before. Johnson certainly had been very critical of the media. But Spiro Agnew went out deliberately to raise questions about whether or not the media was being biased in its coverage. And this further soured the Nixon relationship with the press, although to some degree it also quieted some of the press. They certainly cut down on the analysis of his speeches after he'd given them.
We heard a clip of President Nixon at the top of the program taunting reporters at a 1973 press conference, saying, you know, I'm not mad at you. I can only get mad at somebody that I respect. I imagine that for more than a few, the feeling was mutual. I imagine it was difficult to separate the personal and the professional, and they tended to co-mingle when the president was apparently being personal about the relationship with the press.
I think the worst thing that a politician can appear to a reporter is hypocritical. Nixon, who always presented himself as sort of the average person and the humble man and all the rest of it, it just irked a lot of reporters who were dealing with him on a regular basis. And they also came to distrust what he was saying. And so if you don't believe what the leader is actually saying, then you work all the harder to try to find out what's actually going on. What doesn't he want to know is going on? And so they got to be very successful at finding sources inside the administration that would say, would give a straighter story than the administration would give. And of course, the ultimate symbol of that was Deep Throat, who constantly leaked to the press during the Watergate scandal and kept bringing out news that the administration couldn't suppress and kept the investigation going.
Donald Ritchie, the historian emeritus of the United States Senate and author of the book Reporting from Washington, The History of the Washington Press Corps. On Dialogue today, we're talking about the presidency and the press. We'll pause now for a station break. This is Dialogue from WUOT News. This is Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Our guest, again, if you're just joining us, is Don Ritchie. He's the author of the book Reporting from Washington, The History of the Washington Press Corps. You can tweet your questions to us at WUOTFM. You can also leave a message on our Facebook page if you're interested in some of the history of the president and his relationship across the decades with the reporters that cover him. I want to ask another question about Richard Nixon. We were talking about him before the break, and volumes could be and have been written about his relationship with reporters and those dynamics, certainly as regarded Watergate and, of course, the rest of his presidency. But he had a more complicated relationship with reporters than just confrontational, because he, like Lyndon Johnson, his predecessor, also seemed really concerned about what they were saying about him. We have tapes from the Nixon White House taping system where he and Henry Kissinger, the national security advisor, would discuss how Nixon's speeches had played and what the network commentators were saying about them. And Nixon would in turns say, oh, I don't care what John Chancellor has to say. John Chancellor was at NBC at the time. And then turn around and say, what did John Chancellor say about me? Did he like it? So he seemed to have a really Jekyll and Hyde kind of relationship with the kind of feedback he was getting from the press.
We know that he was quite insecure about his media image, that on one hand he'd say, I don't care, and the next minute he was desperate to know exactly how he was coming across.
Yeah.
And it's very different from practically any other president. We can only guess with other presidents. With Nixon, we actually have him on tape saying what he thinks.
We'll go ahead a little bit further into the 70s. He was followed, of course, by Gerald Ford. And I can, at least in terms of public opinion, Ford came in with some pretty high approval ratings and then a month into office pardoned Richard Nixon to spare him any kind of humiliation, and he said to spare the country from that and the torment of seeing a president go on trial for criminal charges. He said, we're just going to do away with this. I'm going to pardon Richard Nixon, which cratered Ford's approval ratings. How did it affect his relationship with the reporters that covered him?
Well, you know, his press secretary resigned in protest.
That's right. It's Gerald Terhorst, right?
That's right. Yeah. And part of that Ford's problem was that he did the right thing, but he did it the wrong way. That he was right that we needed to bring that Watergate to an end, and that having a former president of the United States go on trial would not have been good for the country after Vietnam and Watergate and the terrible mood that existed in the country at that time. But he sprang it on the country on a Sunday morning on television to announce that he was doing this. And presidents, for the most part, have realized that when they have a controversial issue to deal with, you have to sort of let it out slowly ahead of time. You have to sort of get the press and the public ready for what the announcement's going to be. Otherwise, everybody has to scramble around to interpret it, and the president loses the chance to explain his actions. Ford actually had to go up to testify before Congress afterwards. Mm. This was probably just a bad press decision to rush into the to make that announcement without leaving any hints in advance. I have to say that presidents make the same mistake when they choose their vice presidential candidates. They think somehow that there's going to be some drama to the issue if they can just sort of spring. But when they do that, the press have to run around to figure out who this person is and to write up the account. And to before you know it, the press has taken over the narrative. Mm. That certainly happened with Dan Quayle. It happened to some degree with Sarah Palin as well, that they the presidential candidates hadn't really prepared the press for the decision that they were going to make.
We mentioned Gerald Terhorst a moment ago just in passing. He was President Ford's first press secretary, so now's a good time to talk about the press secretary, this interface between administration, reporters, and by default, the public. There have been press secretaries for decades, not to the extent that we have seen them. Now that we live in the era of the televised White House briefing, it's going out on social media streaming. People are commenting on it in real time. And so folks like Sean Spicer and Sarah Sanders become sort of household names. They become, you know, parodied on Saturday Night Live. They're pop culture figures. That's not always been the case. If you would just give us some impression of the role of the press secretary and how that's changing in this new media era.
Sure. Well, you know, the White House used to be a very small place without a lot of staff. They usually were secretaries who handled a lot of business for presidents, one of which might be press relations. And McKinley had someone like that, a staff person, George Cordeliu, who advised him on press relations, but was never a press secretary. The first president to have a designated press secretary was Herbert Hoover, although there had certainly been press secretaries before that. Joe Tumulty under Woodrow Wilson was a press secretary, but with many other hats that he wore. Now you have somebody who is a designated press secretary. Under Franklin Roosevelt, you had Steve Early, who was one of the finest press secretaries in terms of understanding what it is the press needs and doing his best to get them what they need, with the assumption that if you can provide the press with the kind of information that they're seeking, that they will give you the benefit of the doubt, they'll give you the break when they're reporting. President Eisenhower had a very fine press secretary named Jim Haggerty, again, a former reporter who knew how the press worked. And Haggerty, you know, probably manipulated the press as well as any particular press secretary, and especially when Eisenhower became ill, had a heart attack, so the people were desperate for news, and Haggerty was presenting it in a way that would shed the best light on the administration. At the time, Russell Baker was a New York Times reporter, was stationed at the White House, and he was transferred from the White House to the Capitol. And he said he felt like he was crawling out of a cellar into the open air, finally, that because it had been so controlled under Haggerty in the White House. And in Congress, you really have the free reign of the building with lots of people talking to you. Some presidential secretaries have won the confidence of the press more than others.
I was going to ask you, who do you think would be the model for how well it's done and how well it's not done?
Well, how well it's not done was probably Richard Nixon's press secretary.
Ron Ziegler.
Ziegler was a man who clearly worked for the president alone, and really the press were on their own, essentially. And the press came to distrust everything that he was saying, which is really a very poor relationship that exists. I mentioned Hagerty. I mentioned you could also talk about Pierre Salinger, who was mm-hmm. Kennedy's press secretary, who had a very good relationship with the press. You had press secretaries who were sort of straddling the situation. Poor Bill Moyers. was trying to keep Lyndon Johnson happy and trying to keep the press happy, and it was almost impossible to do both of those things at the same time. And so the other problem is that these press secretaries now are expected to go on television to do briefings that used to be done in the back rooms with just a bunch of reporters standing around them. It's much harder to control things in the when you're on television, and it's now become a sparring match rather than actually providing information.
Well, that gets us to our current relationship between the president and the press, which I think it's fair to say is pretty toxic right now. We've spent much of this hour talking about the way previous presidents have handled that relationship, and we've seen some parallels in Richard Nixon and his distrust of the press. What do you see in the current environment that feels like some of those past situations, and what do you see that seems new and unique?
Well, one of the big changes in the last 20 years has been the whole digital revolution. With all the types of programs that are coming on, starting with cable television. Bill Clinton thought that was the way he was going to govern, by going on Larry King and programs like that. Then you get the internet coming along, and you get streaming, and you get tweeting that are coming along. Each president has tried to figure out how to use this media, first off, to motivate people to go out to vote for them, and that's something that the Obama campaign was just superb at, using social media to generate votes especially among younger people, who have a very low percentage of turning out to vote on election days. But then in terms of governing, it's a matter of keeping your supporters, your base, as they call it, on your side. And certainly President Trump has decided that his Twitter accounts are more important than anything that he says to the press, that people sort of feel as if he's talking directly to them in these very short, usually very pithy and usually very angry tweets that come out in the middle of the night from the White House. It's something new, but of course that kind of media is only recently available to presidents. You wonder, for instance, what would Franklin Roosevelt have done if he'd had a Twitter feed?
Or Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon, other two that we've talked about, who were very concerned about their image in the press. It seems like, though we are looking at what I think is probably a unique situation, this is not identical to the kind of tit-for-tat we saw in the Nixon administration or at other tense times. I think there is some new here, and the medium is only part of it. As you're looking now as an historian, how do you put this into context? Is this sort of, there's nothing new under the sun? Does it feel like, because there have been these medium shifts before and sort of disruptions from that. Is this totally new, totally old, a little bit of both?
Well, you know, Mark Twain once said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it sometimes rhymes. And so we get these refrains that come back and forth, although it may not be the same. This is a very unusual presidency. And in fact, I've done a lot of oral histories over the years with people who worked in Washington. And one thing I've heard from several people is that each president of the United States brings his past to the office, and he runs his presidency the way he's been used to operating. So if a person was a governor before, or if they served in the Senate before, or if they were a general before, they tend to bring that form of operation into office. President Trump is really the very first president who has absolutely no political experience prior to becoming president, no government experience. He's bringing in his private operation, because he dealt with the press for years as a developer in New York, but he did that in a way it was essentially public relations and promoting his image and his name that he was selling as a brand. And he's doing the same, I suppose, in office, because that's the way he's used to operating. But because there was never anyone quite like him before in office, it's very different approach to the presidency than we've ever seen. And it's left a lot of people in Washington in both parties scratching their heads, trying to figure out just what he thinks he's doing and whether or not this will be successful.
I guess a corollary to that is, and you mentioned this, is that President Trump, of course, was familiar to many of us through his relations with the media, usually as a pop culture figure or somebody who would be, you know, on the news or have his own TV show. But I think even he was surprised by the level of scrutiny that you face, even if you're used to the public eye, when you get to the White House. We've seen other presidents chafe under that as well. I'm sure other presidents have been bugged, I think, not in the Nixonian sense, I mean annoyed. But the idea, like Jack Kennedy, who you said had, of course, dealings with the press, liked working with the press. There was a speech early in his career, or early in the presidency, in April of 61, which he chastised reporters. It felt very much more like a modern kind of presidential speech, where he says, look, you guys are printing bad stuff about me. Stop it. This isn't fair. You know, which is a very un-JFK, at least the way we think of him today. So is there some surprise? Do you think there's a learning curve for presidents, even those who may be familiar with the press, once they actually get to the spotlight?
Yes. Well, it's actually a truism for all of politics. A person runs for local office and they get minor scrutiny from the media. They move up to running for a national office, like the House of Representatives, and they get more scrutiny. They move up to the Senate, run for the Senate, and then there's a lot more attention. They're often quite surprised that people are questioning them about things that they'd never been questioned about before in all their previous races. And then you run for president, and again, it's a whole new level of in which the press is trying to dissect you to figure out who you are, what you've been doing, how honest you're being in what you're doing. It takes everybody, I think, even the old pros like Lyndon Johnson, who had been around for a very long time, took them by surprise to realize how differently you would be treated as you move into a new position. So I'm sure that for President Trump, who's used to, the quasi-reality shows, that that the media is treating him differently than he did when he was on The Apprentice.
Do you think he vacillates back and forth, too? I've heard this, at least from some White House correspondents, the way we talked about Johnson and Nixon earlier in this hour, like he will hold the press at arm's length or go on national television and savage them, but then say, but he wants to be liked by reporters. He wants to get along with reporters. When he interacts with them face-to-face, he seems to be fairly friendly. There seems to be that dichotomy again.
Well, everybody likes to be liked. Nobody wants to be hated, and presidents flatter themselves to some degree to think that they have good interpersonal skills. And on a one-on-one basis, they also realize that reporters are well-informed. They're usually interesting people. You can have a great conversation with them. They're quite fascinating, and they're very knowledgeable. And so you often have these situations in which presidents have wonderful relations on a one-on-one basis, even though they can't stand the press corps as a whole. It's partly because they can't control the press corps, and they really want to be able to manipulate and to determine what goes out. They want the public to hear things the way they see it, that's not the job of the press.
Does that seem, then, that that's a commonality, regardless, as I put it earlier this hour, of party, politics, platform? That seems to be the common thread for almost any president, is they want to be heard, they want people on their side, and they sometimes see reporters as an obstruction to that.
Well, a lot of the Washington reporters have asked me, when did the relationship between the press corps and the presidency really get so sour? And I said, well, when George Washington was president, he had the same kinds of problems with the press, and it drove him to distraction. So essentially, it's always been there. And in fact, you have to assume that it's going to be there. You have to think of ways in which you can deal with that sort of rivalry. And it should never get to a situation where the presidents and the press are actually in lockstep. We always need to have skepticism. We need to have people who are looking beyond the press release and trying to find out what's going on behind closed doors. That's the real job of the media.
Even when it causes some headaches at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, I imagine.
And especially.
especially. Donald Ritchie is the historian emeritus of the United States Senate. He's also the author of the interesting book, Reporting from Washington, The History of the Washington Press Corps. Mr. Ritchie, thank you so much for an enlightening conversation.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dialogue is a production of WUOT News. Greg Hill is our producer. Special thanks go out today to Carl Kraft at NPR in Washington, who helped arrange today's connection with Mr. Ritchie. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.